Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
When I came to, I had incredible trouble hearing because my eardrums had been blown out from the blast. And I had this American doctor came in and without any warning, he started telling me about what I had to be careful of. And he was saying how when suicide bombs, they often put feces and things like that so that if it doesn't kill you, you'll get an infection. The kids that they use have often been sexually assaulted, so quite often they've got HIV. And going through this and saying, so you won't be able to hug, kiss or do anything to any of your family until you're cleared. You know, at this stage I didn't even know I'd been blown up by a suicide bomber, you know. A child.
The Australian Federal Police, or the AFP, was established in the wake of the 1978 bombing of the Hilton Hotel in Sydney. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser and 11 other heads of state were staying in the hotel at the time for the Commonwealth Heads of State meeting, also known as CHOGM. The bomb, planted in a bin outside the hotel, was detonated when two council garbage collectors attempted to empty it. They were killed instantly, as was a member of New South Wales Police. 11 other people were injured, including the two men driving the garbage truck and several other police members. This unprecedented terrorist attack on Australian soil was the motivation the government needed to greenlight a single federal law enforcement agency. We've mentioned the AFP many times on Australian True Crime, but do any of us really know what they do? Our guest today, who reached the very top of the tree in the organisation, may change the way you think about the role of the Australian Federal Police. For one thing, his brilliant career was brought to a grinding halt when he was supposed to be protected by a bunch of Americans on a dusty road in Afghanistan. David Savage is now the president of the Australian Federal Police Former Members Association, and he's particularly passionate about securing better mental health support, both for serving members and for retired members. I have a feeling that by the time you get to the end of this episode, you'll understand why. I caught up with David recently, and we started our conversation by talking about his deployment in East Timor in 1999. He was sent there by our government during what is now known as the East Timorese crisis. During that period, the tiny community was preparing to vote on the question of independence from Indonesia.
So I was there with the what they called the UNAMET mission, which was from June up until INTERFET arrived, which was the 20th of September. So we were there in the period to help the UN run the what they call the popular consultation or the election to allow the Timorese people to decide whether they wanted to stay with the occupiers, the Indonesians, or whether they wanted to reject that and ultimately gain independence. There was 52 Australian police and 8 or 10 Australian military observers, so about 60 Australians. We were all unarmed. We didn't have any ballistic equipment. But also because of the agreements, what they called the May 5th agreement, there was no peacekeepers ready to come in to back us up or whatever. So we had no one there to protect us, and our job was to advise the Indonesian police on security, which was essentially trying to cajole them to actually act and protect the civilian population. And at the same time, the Indonesian military had created these militias and they were attacking the independence people. So it was a very, very violent situation. So we were the only thin blue line for one another, and just using our presence, our negotiation skills, and often our bodies to try and protect people. But, you know, they were, especially as it got close to the vote, the Indonesians realised that they had tried to get us to leave, to that it would attack us and attack civilians. And because for 24 years they'd been able to intimidate the Timorese population, they thought they could do the same to us. However, we refused to leave.
Well, also because Australia as a nation had really left them to it.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, were you shocked at the level of violence and the level of aggression that you even witnessed, let alone was directed at you?
Look, I was. I'd seen tiny little bits on other overseas things, but nothing on the scale of this.
We had such, and we still do, have such a close diplomatic relationship. I was shocked, frankly, that the troops would be allowed to carry out that sort of violence, even in front of observers.
Well, what they tried to do was to use these militias as proxies. So it didn't look like it was the Indonesians, but a lot of these militias were actually Indonesian soldiers dressed up with wigs and wearing clothing so that they appeared to be these militias.
And using Indonesian army-issued guns.
Absolutely. And, you know, you'd see them, they'd have T-shirts on for, you know, pro-autonomy, pro-independence and stuff. But you look down and they had their military pants and military boots on. And as it got closer to the vote and after it, they'd be then carrying their military rifles, automatic rifles, you know. So, look, we kept getting information that was what was planned, that if the vote took place and if Indonesia was rejected, that they had what they called a scorched earth policy, that they were going to destroy everything that Indonesia had ever put in there. And, you know, they'd had all this rhetoric, you know, the blood would flow through the streets and this. But what they actually talked about doing, I don't think any of us could actually envisage that it was possible to do. The scale of what they were threatening, it almost was, it was ridiculous. How can you destroy a country when the world's looking on? You know, you've got the United Nations there. We're a couple of hundred kilometres from Australia. But literally, once the vote happened and had a massive turnout, 98 or 99% of the population turned out, and out of that, almost 80% voted to reject Indonesia. Literally, the attacks and at the town where I was, which is very close to the border with West Timor, was the first one attacked. And, you know, we had a whole pile of our Timorese locally engaged UN staff were massacred straight away. And then the town was just burning the whole, you know, we're trying to get our local staff, trying to bring them into, but we also had about 50 or 60 international UN staff that we had to try and consolidate into one place. And, you know, they'd started, you know, machine gunning our house. And and you don't know what's in their mind when you're laying on the floor in the middle of the night and the whole town's ablaze and, we're being shot at. And, so the next morning we had to go and collect everybody that we could. But the whole, at the police, the Indonesian police station, there were several hundred Indonesian police just standing there watching as these militias were going and burning the town, destroying everything. Actually, at that police station, about 6 days afterwards, there was one of the largest massacres there of pro-independence supporters. A lot of people had been encouraged to go there to for protection, and they'd gotten there, but in fact it was a trap, and the Indonesian police surrounded the police station so they couldn't escape, and then the Indonesian military led these militias in, and they had a list of pro-independence people, and they massacred them then and there. So we ended up eventually being evacuated after a siege in the UN compound in Dili for about a week, and then the military, Australian military, then evacuated us. But we still had to get from the UN compound in Dili back to the airport, which was about 10 kilometres, and we had to make our own way. And even though we were leaving, they still shot at the UN vehicles and that kind of thing. And it's not a story that's very well known, because for most Australians, the story started with the intervention with General Cosgrove and that going in. But actually, in fact, 99% of the murders and the destruction of the country actually happened before Interfet came in. It happened while we were there. All of us were, incredibly traumatised. We'd literally seen people in front of us being hacked to death. We thought we were going to be murdered. We thought, it was beyond comprehension. And things were put in place. When we got out in Darwin, people came around and said, it was terrible, blah, blah, blah. And then we never heard another thing. I went back to work and asked for 2 weeks off. And my boss said, you've just had a holiday in the South Pacific. The Austrian police officer who was my partner there, who by fluke we had worked in Mozambique together prior to that, so we were good mates and we'd gone into all these horrendous situations trying to save people. And he went home, signed his gun out and blew his brains out. And he just couldn't live with what he'd seen. And even after that happened to him, no one asked if I was okay. And now, 20-odd years later, we've still not had any support, even though we've contacted the AFP and said there's groups of us that are doing it tough. There's no Department of Veterans Affairs for police. So once you leave, that's it. And that's part of the reason we've got this Veterans Association, so we can try and start building support. Mental health is something that in policing has never really been addressed. Soldiers might go to war for 6 months of their career or whatever, but one of the things about policing is you live in your battlefield, so to speak. So you might go to a critical incident, whether it's a fatal car accident or a sexual assault of a child or whatever, and you might have to drive past that location constantly or whatever, but you're reminded, and I know people who've been out of the police for 20, 30 years will say, I can't drive that way because if I go past X spot, it reminds me, I get flashbacks and I whatever. But the problem was, in the past, no one was game to it's a very macho alpha male thing. I joined at 18 in the early 80s. No one would ever say, oh, that affected me, or I'm not travelling so well, or whatever. I remember going to the suicide of a colleague who I came on afternoon shift. He was on day shift. We had a chat. Thought he was going home, and he went to kill himself. 15 minutes later, I'm at where he took his life, and dealing with that. There was, we better go and have a few beers, but there was never any counselling or never any follow-up, and no one would put their hand up because, you're not up to it.
You would have, I suppose, been back on shift the next day.
Oh, I worked the whole night and then had a couple hours sleep back on. And yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
But you ended up working at the pointy end of international policing for your entire career. I mean, you never took a less stressful job, if you could help it. You worked in counterterrorism, in war crimes, and in investigating people smuggling.
Yeah, so I worked in East Timor was the first place. Then I went to Miami. I was working on a human trafficking project there for a while in Miami, Burma. And it became very clear to me, I'm a bit of a cynic, funnily enough, that there was no political will. And part of the problem was that, you have to have control of or have ins with those controlling the borders to be able to undertake human trafficking. And the same police that we were supposed to train and do this were the ones that were unfortunately facilitating the human trafficking. And there was no political will from the Myanmar police or government to do anything, whether it was drugs. They'd give up a few, the senior military would run with these warlords up in the Golden Triangle. They would run the whole narcotics industry and things. And every now and then they would give up somebody, and it was usually someone who wasn't paying enough bribe to someone else. They'd make a sacrifice. And you knew that the way what the military was doing in the rest of the country, cracking down on the different ethnic groups and things. So after a while, I realised that I was wasting my time there.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that's just down to pure economics?
In Burma, the corruption there and the influence of China, from Mandalay North, everything was Chinese. So the Chinese would come down, they would just pillage all the forests, all the timber, all the jade mines, all the natural resources were being just, the whole place being ravaged with, no kind of, we'll take this tree and leave three others or plant, they just cut everything down. And an incredibly beautiful country with incredible natural resources, but in the hands of the military and in the hands of corrupt officials. So there certainly was, if there was a rule of law and, the country could have been successful, but with the military dictatorship, it was never going to happen.
So how do you communicate that? As your job, I'm assuming you've got KPIs.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I'm...
So what do you communicate back to your superiors? You realise, oh, okay, this isn't happening. Is that what you tell your boss? You just go, mate.
I'm not one of those people that can sit there and put a rosy glow on something,
But it's good that you're listened to, it's good that you're in a position where you can say that, I guess.
Well, sometimes. But what I decided after a while was, of saying, putting in reports saying, really, we're just not getting any traction here, and I'll give an example of how serious they took. So we would run training courses for the police, and we would have basic investigator courses, and then we'd build up to complex transnational crime investigation courses. One of the things that we would do is get the list of participants so we could check to make sure that they weren't on a list of human rights abusers and that kind of thing. One of the courses we were doing, a basic investigators course, I'd been trying to get the list of participants for quite a few weeks, and a week out, still no list. We should have just cancelled the course. But anyway, pressure to get KPIs and all that kind of stuff. So a decision was made to proceed with the course, and my counterpart assured me that he would, on the morning of the course, provide me with all the detailed CVs of all the participants. Anyway, so the course starts, and we've got everybody in the classroom. They're the most punctual people on earth. They would be there sitting at their desk half an hour before the course would start. Anyway, so we were all gathered there, and to break the ice, I would sit down and talk about my family, my life, what I'd done in the police and blah, blah, blah. Then I'd go around and ask each participant. I was very pleased because there was probably about 40% female participants, which is really good. First person, a woman, middle-aged woman, 40, 45 there. So I said, can you tell me a bit about yourself and where, your police service and stuff? And she stands up. She says, I'm a librarian. And I go, oh, I said, are you in the library at the police training academy? Or and she looked at me like the moron I was. And she goes, no, I'm from the library down the road. I said, oh, so you're not a police officer. And of course, the Myanmar police officials are all shuffling in their seat very uncomfortably. And she said, no, well, apparently I will be this afternoon. They came and grabbed me and said I had to do this course and they're going to give me a uniform this afternoon and I'll be a policeman and I just want to be a librarian. Anyway, and I was like, oh, okay, maybe this is a bit of an aberration. But we went round and each one had been press ganged, you know, completely the opposite of what we're trying to achieve. And another course at the end of the course, you know, we started to try and train the trainers with some of their central training instructors. And I was so proud. The course had gone really, really well. We'd have scenarios and, you know, really put a lot of work and a lot of funding in it. Had to do things by international standards, rule of law, you know, evidence-based investigations and prosecutions. And I had this guy who was the senior investigator trainer at their central training academy. So he'd been shadowing me through the whole course and he seemed, you know, really committed. And I was like, this is going so well. So I had the Australian ambassador and the head of AusAid and things present at the graduation so that they could give the certificates and they could see, you know, how we're going. And I gave a bit of a talk and I said how proud I was to work side by side with, you know, such a open-minded instructor and things, and just wondering if you could just say a few words to the class about their future and how they can utilize what they've learned. And he gets up and he says, you know, all the right things are, you know, Mr. David, he brings some incredibly good ideas here and the way that they do in other countries. And I'm glancing across and, you know, the ambassador's sitting up going, this is good. Head of AusAid, who's a personal friend now, she's sort of, you know, give me the thumbs up. This is perfect, you know. And he goes, but, he said, have you noticed how long it takes to finish a case and that compared to how we do it? He said, it's a very, very inefficient way. And I'm sort of like, you know, because it's being translated. He said, let's face it, you chain them up to a chair and then you start to beat them. And he said, you'll soon find out, they'll confess. And I'm going, I think we need to have a break for a morning tea. So all the brownie points I thought I'd got were like, yeah, yeah. So it got to the end of my contract and I was having serious ethical concerns. Because, so, you know, if you think you can make a change, you keep going. But if you think that you're just a fig leaf to cover up for a change that's never going to happen, and it was a very, very well-paid position. And, you know, my wife had given up her job in Australia to move over there. We'd done this. And we're just talking about, and I said, look, I just don't think I can keep doing this, you know. And I think it was a Thursday. I had to sign my contract on the Monday. It was a Thursday. And the Friday, I got an email from the UN saying, do you want to go and work in Sri Lanka on war crimes? And I went, oh, yeah. So I gave myself the weekend and yeah, then I left and then started working over there.
I must admit, I'm unaware. Do you mean war crimes as in war with the Tamils?
So, yeah, so...
Civil war?
Civil war. So...
Okay.
So the time that I went across there, there'd been a ceasefire or a truce, which came about after the Boxing Day tsunami, because it was over 100,000 Sri Lankans had been killed in the tsunami and, you know, many more homeless. And it was a Norwegian-led truce or ceasefire negotiations, 2004, early 2005. Then in 2005, the Rajapaksa family took over the government. He's a very far-right nationalist, and his platform was the defeat of the Tamil Tigers. Then a number of attacks started to take place, breaches of the ceasefire, some pretty egregious massacres and killings, and so the war started up again. We had 17 cases that we had to look for. The Sri Lankans wouldn't allow it to be called a UN investigation because they were above having the UN come in to look at them. So what was created was this project called the International Independent Group of Eminent Persons. So there was a pile of these eminent persons from around the world who came in and were to oversight what they called a presidential commission of inquiry, exactly the same as one of our royal commission, but this was into the 17 cases of egregious violations of human rights. I wasn't one of the eminent persons, so each eminent person had a not-so-eminent person with them who had a certain expertise who could advise them, and I had a fantastic man. He was an American. He had been the former Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees, and he was a former Assistant Secretary of State, a guy named Gene Dewey, one of the nicest, most decent men you'd ever find in the world. And we had people from the UN Human Rights Council, really heavy hitters, really super, super smart people. But what we didn't realise is that what the Sri Lankan government, for years and years and years, whenever they have had an issue, they create their equivalent of a royal commission. But no one had ever finished them or they actually had royal commissions into royal commissions. And it took 6 months before the commission actually even sat. But anyway, we stretched our mandate dramatically to actually start doing investigations because we were supposed to only oversight. And what we found out was that people were being threatened or given a script before they went in to give evidence. And the counsel assisting was actually involved in this conspiracy. So he wouldn't ask the most obvious questions that should have been asked to these people about, what things had happened, and they'd have a script. So, all the evidence is being hidden. Anyway, so we started to do our own inquiries and investigations. And what we found out that in a number of the cases, it looked like it was the Tamil Tigers had undertaken these egregious crimes. We found that actually the government security forces had killed even their own people so that they could poor people bomb a railway station in a really poor part of the country and blame it on the Tamil Tigers. So this was so that the war could start again. And they also, what was interesting is that these three Rajapaksa brothers, one was the president, one was the minister for defence, the other one was the finance minister. So they pretty well had everything covered. But they'd started their own company. So any armaments and military equipment had to come in through their company before it went to the security forces. So it was in their financial interests to have the war ramp up and keep going. Once we started to investigate these things and they stupidly allowed us to start asking questions in the Commission of Inquiry. So we'd ask questions that were obvious to anyone that should be asked. And
so when they realised that you knew, which there must have been a moment where they realised, oh, shit, they know, was there a change in the way you were treated and the way your sort of life was going on?
Well, things got worse than chilly. There was a bit of a system there where you'd get the cold shoulder, you get hints, they'd publicise things about you, and then they'd kill you. It set up accidents and that kind of thing. There was a number of people that we interviewed who were really key to some of the most egregious crimes that you could ever, ever imagine, that we had to get asylum into other countries. And they weren't just Tamils. They were journalists who had tried to expose the truth. They were human rights advocates. So we had to work with different countries in order to try and sneak them out of the country and get them asylum and that kind of thing. It's quite a hair-raising process. We got more than 100 out. Well, what happened then was that they started to publish, because there's a government newspaper, about how we were what they called white tigers, which meant that we were sympathetic to the Tamil Tigers. And nothing could have been further from the truth. The Tamil Tigers were the first group to implement suicide bombing, for example. And, we were as critical of both sides because both sides did some absolutely horrendous stuff. But things came to a head when they published on the front page of the newspaper saying that David Savage was a personal friend of one of the senior Tamil Tigers, school friends, Not sure how they worked that one out, that I was sympathetic, that I was pushing for the destruction of the motherland, which I'd go on with. Anyway, so if you'd like to express your dissatisfaction with him being here, this is his address and this is his phone number. So at that stage, I got a call from the US Embassy, because as I was working with the American, and they said, you're leaving. Within a day or so, we were out. We all ended up leaving. We continued the investigations from outside of Sri Lanka for many more years, and we wrote the sort of landmark report about when the war continued and the destruction of the Tamil Tigers, but more importantly, the carpet bombing and artillery barrages, which killed over 40,000 men, women and children, who were being held essentially as human shields by the LTT. They didn't want to be there, but they literally, in order to kill the Tamil Tigers, they just killed everyone.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, the day that suddenly ended David Savage's career in the Australian Federal Police and also changed his life forever.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
By 2011, The War on Terror by the Coalition of the Willing, announced by President George W. Bush in 2003, had turned into a seemingly endless exercise against an ever-evolving enemy on their own terms all the time. At home, the coalition countries were facing voters who were increasingly sceptical or completely disinterested in the war. It was a money pit without a glorious victory in sight. But in May of that year, there was renewed hope when Osama bin Laden was finally located and killed by American forces. Not long after that, American diplomats met with Taliban contacts for high-level and very secret negotiations. It's not known exactly what those negotiations were about, but less than 2 years later, President Obama announced an impending withdrawal of combat troops from Afghanistan. In the middle of all that, our friend David Savage received an exciting job offer. To put it into that timeline, it was not long after the bin Laden operation that David received the call. I'll let him pick up the story.
So the preparation, and I'll say preparation in inverted commas because it was really appalling. And the excuse was, oh, this is a new role, so you've got to make it your own, you know, that usual rubbish that people say when they have no clue of what you're supposed to do. We were part of this Kevin Rudd-led Australian Civilian Corps. So he was trying to get a seat on the Security Council, so he was trying to replicate the, I guess, the US Peace Corps and all that kind of stuff. So I just happened to be a DFAT employee, seconded to the role, whilst others came from outside of the public service or the Australian public service. The two other people, so the three of us went, one of them was very, very experienced, and he'd spent 5 years in Afghanistan, not in Uruzgan, but in other parts. Former Australian Army officer, worked for the UN for decades, you know, and spoke Pashtun and some Dari. So we fly there. We've been given figures about money and stuff that was being spent there. But as I said, once again, no context. You don't know what that money is able to buy or to do anything.
Where were they at with the budget? As you said, you know, you see these numbers, but they're meaningless until you get there and you start to have an understanding of what's happening there.
So what we understood our role was to obviously, you know, with stabilisation advisors, bring some stability to the district, but also do some meaningful work and bring valuable resources to the people there. What we realised, the three of us, we felt like outsiders, both within the civilian community, but then we were the only civilians on military bases. What we, the three of us, came to realise was we were there to essentially buy everyone off so that they could withdraw. So to flood the community with projects and money so they'd feel happy. It's almost like they wouldn't notice that you're withdrawing. And that wasn't our brief. And we were 10 years, essentially 10 years too late. So people like me should have been working there from the get-go. No matter how good and well-meaning the military are, they're just not trained. That's not their gig to win over people. So I'll give you an example. One of the Dutch had put a project, the main project that at the time, I think it was $20 million, right, to run a road from Tarinkout to Chora, where I was. And in the initial plans, there were to be no culverts, that is, pipes underneath the road, because people can put IEDs there, which is the greatest threat. Well, they put in 100-and-something culverts. So 100-and-something places where you can put IEDs that can't be seen. And part of the reason that they got away with, the contractors got away with doing that was because people hadn't been going out there and monitoring the road because it's too dangerous.
So these foreign governments are paying local contractors to do all this work?
Usually foreign, big development sort of engineering companies, and they will send a couple of adventurous types there to hire the local staff and the contractors to get it done. But you need the people that are paying it to say, hang on, what are you doing? And one thing I never saw was an amount of what my budget was. It was just like, whatever you need. One of my first roles was troubleshooting, you know, well-meaning soldiers from the PRT, the Provincial Reconstruction Team, had no experience in contracting or dealing with people, you know, they're soldiers, had engaged a guy to put three wells in this village. They paid him the money up front. You know, the money you're giving him is the most money he's ever seen in his life. You know, they paid three lots of $5,000 to drill three wells. So he drilled one well in his backyard and then owned the water. So instead of solving water problems, we'd actually created a problem where one guy monopolized the water for the village and we'd paid for it, so they hated us. You know, so my first job was to try and negotiate and get two extra wells. And then in the process, you know, we're like, well, how much does a well cost here? Clearly no one in this town or this province can afford to pay $5,000 to get a well. Why are we paying it? You know what I mean? And, well, the most a well should cost is about $800, right?
the worst case I saw, and I won't say who paid it, but was up to $100,000 for a tube well because they kept asking for more money because once they'd spent a certain amount, they couldn't back off because they didn't have any to show for the money. But they just didn't take enough notice or care to note that they were being ripped off, or they consciously thought, yeah, this is our rep, but we're just giving them money, they'll love us, or something.
Do you think that, like, when other countries were in charge of the job, they allowed this crazy price gouging gravy train?
Absolutely. One of the things that I and my colleagues did was try to take a responsible approach to it.
But I think that may have been your downfall, mate.
I've got no doubt that was part of the motivation.
I think we we have to be really clear about the fact that aid money was ending up with the Taliban. I don't know how much, and we can't say how much, but I mean, it was, you know, some of it was ending up funding the Taliban.
Oh, without a doubt, there's no doubt at all that when you flood a community with money, that the Taliban aren't going to, some of the people are going to be Taliban, but also the Taliban are going to put the squeeze on people to get the money. They can see what's being built or constructed, and they know money's coming into it. So, yeah, definitely. We had one guy, which I can't think of his full name, but Brown Eyes was his nom de guerre, a very, very nasty piece of work, and he had refused to engage with us, and there was always this suspicion that he was Taliban, which, as it turned out, he was. And he, as I said, wouldn't engage, but then would try to turn the other tribes and things against us, but me, because I was the face of it. One of the problems was one of his sons was working for the project to build the flood mitigation. It was about a $6 million project to stop the snow melt, washing the town and the roads away and things. And there'd been a brilliant negotiation before I arrived where there was a proportional representation from every village. So say it was 10% or whatever. So if you had 100 young men, 10 of them would work on the project. Another village might have 300, but they 30 worked. And it was fairly done to spread the money. And every tribal leader had signed off on it. All happy. And then early 2012, so maybe eight weeks before I was blown up, he started agitating that he needed more labourers working on this project. And his son working in the project was clearly up to no good trying to make that happen. Because what happens if you've got 20 labourers or 50 labourers, say they're getting $10 a day, he's going to take 8 of that. And so the more labourers from his village, the more money he gets, which is what his motivation is. So my response to him was, it's not up to me to make the decision because the money's not coming from, you're actually going to be taking money from other tribes.
Mm.
So if the other tribes agree, yeah, sure, but I'm not going to make that decision. And he kept wanting to come and meet me privately then after having not refused to meet me for 6 months, whatever. He wanted to meet me on the side. And I said, well, no, we've got to be transparent and we'll meet with the governor and we'll meet with the other tribes so that they can see what you're proposing. Well, of course, he didn't want to do that, yeah. Refused to do that. So he kept, through his son, would come and demand, and I mean literally, really forcefully demand that I would go then and now to meet him and things. And one of the problems, A, was about, obviously, I can't be seen to be kowtowing to one of the local strongmen, but also what was he setting me up to be,
yeah,
you know, ambushed or blown up or whatever?
Because the previous governor was assassinated, right? So, I mean.
And, you know, three police chiefs.
Yeah.
You know, like it was a common thing and a very, very dangerous area. So, you know, I had got into not an argument but quite a strong discussion with the son and just saying, I'm not going to meet your father. I'm not going to do that. And so he then tried to turn it that I was against his father. And, of course, it made him look, I guess, weak because he couldn't convince me or force me to to bend to his will. Yeah, so I knew I hadn't made any friends there.
But, I mean, it was surely to your advantage with all the other leaders.
Yes, absolutely. Everybody else was quite fearful of this guy, and I got messages or people would come to the thing and saying, thank you, because, you know, you'd stood up to this guy.
Mm. So that's why you were such a target. You're costing this guy money, and your presence there is, to his mind, only going to cost him more and more money.
Exactly. And then it was very soon after that that what they call night leaders started to appear. You're in a district where literally 5% are literate.
Mm.
And, you know, obviously we were putting schools in to change that. But the more people that could read and write that were literate, the less people that could be manipulated.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Taliban and other people weren't in favour of that. So, as you can see now with the Taliban banning women from education and things.
Well, that's it. I mean, the first thing they don't want is people being able to read the Quran, for one thing.
Absolutely.
We'll tell you what's in it. Don't worry. We'll tell you what it says.
That's exactly what they do. So what they would do is put these night leaders at the small mosques, village mosques, and the Malik, who is like the lay preacher, who gets the job because he can read and write, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he'd tell what was people, exactly like you said, what's in the Quran, and, you know, if it's a good area, he'd tell the truth. If it's a bad area, he'd tell what the Taliban wanted him to say. But they'd post these night letters, and they're called night letters because they'd be put out during the middle of the night and, you know, like nailed to the little mosque. And then the Malik would read it and then inform the people. And they were always threats about, so, that, you know, that's why they'd be put out during the night, because the Taliban had put them out there. So I had a number of night letters came out in the 2 or 3 weeks before I was attacked and ambushed. It was saying, if you speak to or work with the AusAid person, you'll suffer the consequences. We're going to, you know, do things against him because he's against us, and, you know, these sort of things.
I mean, you knew you were in danger from the moment you arrived. Did you take that extra seriously? What did you think? Obviously, you didn't think you were going to be blown up, or you really in your heart of hearts, or you'd have left.
I came back from leave, I think, in January. You had a midterm break or whatever you call it. And during that, I just extended. Don't know what I was thinking.
Oh, my God.
been asked to extend to, I think it was the end of October or November. I was supposed to leave in the end of April was my initial contract. And I actually, you know, I liked the work. I loved the challenge. And, of course, going back to DFAT, I was going to be sitting behind a computer, you know, so that wasn't really something that thrilled me to tears, you know. And, look, so I've got, at the time, my children were grown up. They weren't kids. And just before I left, and I've never had it before, but I just had this really bad sense of foreboding. My son must have detected it. He said, you don't have to go back, Dad. And I said, oh, no. I said, I can't remember the exact words, but I said to him, you know, if something happens, you know, do X, Y, and Z, you know. And I did have this, and I couldn't put my finger on it. So went back, and I didn't, you know, I didn't dwell on it or didn't not go out or anything, because, you know, we're still going out, you know, 4 or 5 and sometimes 5 or 6 days a week out, what they call outside the wire, so outside the base and into the community, because you couldn't do much if you don't meet people, you know. But we had a new Australian contingent at the base, and you're always a bit uneasy until you know them and trace them, and they were great. There was absolutely no issue with the Australians at all. They were fantastic. But the new US security detachment, the US before were National Guard, and there were some, you know, really well-meaning guys that I have no doubt would never have let anything happen to me, like, unless they were killed, you know what I mean? They really were dedicated to their task. The new group I guess the best way to describe them was they were cowboys. They thought they knew everything. And the outgoing group tried to, you know, brief them and things, and they just wouldn't listen. They knew, the whole. The other problem we had is we hadn't been able to do a number of what they call handover patrols because there'd been massive sandstorms, so which meant that the medevac helicopters and gunships and that couldn't fly, so no one was allowed outside the wire during this period. So about mid-March, I think it was, I was tasked to arrange a visit to Chora at the base by a really, really high-level Australian official. So we had Director General of AusAid, so the very head of AusAid was coming. Paul Simon, who's just finished up as the head of ACES, I knew Paul from East Timor quite well, but he was the head of DIO, the Defence Intelligence Organisation, Deputy Commissioner from the AFP, you know, senior generals were coming. But, of course, we couldn't let the Afghan people know. So what we've got to do is we've got to, what they call, scope out how we can do it without letting anyone become suspicious about what we're doing. Now, I was tasked with organising a 100% what they call dismounted on foot, not in vehicles, so which means they'd fly into the LZ at the base, and then we'd go on foot to the district headquarters and visit all these things. So I went and did a recce on this with both the Australians at the base, because I think they were going to take major role of the perimeter security, but special forces were coming in for each of those people to, funnily enough, they weren't going to let US National Guard protect them. And I should add that we had to make sure that all of the district officials were actually going to be at the office that day, because there's no point people coming from Australia essentially to meet these people if that was a day they were going to be inspecting something or they decided to have a day off or whatever. So I had to come up with a fake reason that everyone had to come, had to be at the office.
But you had to keep it so secret that these guys were coming to town that you couldn't even tell them.
No. So on the, I've got a feeling it was like 8 o'clock we were going to head off. So we got to go down, grab a brew and whatever for breakfast. Then you had to line up at a set time. I think it was probably 7:30, where they checked your equipment before what they call you stepped out. So we do that. And then they radio, seek permission to leave. We're just about to, literally just about to step off. And this guy says, can I come too? They had a thing where you had to be on the tab or something. You had to submit the names the night before of who was going, so to go to Tarancourt to approve them. So it was like, oh, your name's not on the list or the tab or whatever. So instead of coming back inside and doing starting all over again, we wait in full view of the town whilst permission for this guy to come. So there's 16 plus me, 17 and him, 19 of us standing there, but it took so long we eventually sat down. It should never have been allowed to happen. This chap, Brad, was a spook, which I had no idea.
By which you mean what? I mean CIA or something like that?
But in America, in military uniform.
Yeah, but that's why it was allowed to happen. That's why.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
So we've all waited for this guy, and then we head off. Tim Diggs, one of the guys, 100% of the time had a helmet cam video on.
Roger. Right. Yeah, we're gonna go through the bazaar, through the market.
I've looked at the video. I couldn't remember the trip there at all, but I've looked at the helmet cam video, and you can tell just by the atmosphere in the town that people are uneasy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it starts off, we're outside the office just about putting our gear on, and some locals come up and ask for whether we can meet them and whether we can give them certain things. Clearly what they're doing is delaying us.
Of course, yep.
But everyone's oblivious, you know, and you can see I'm trying to say, yep, okay, yep, come and, you know, we got to go. And we head off, putting our gear on. It's chatter about, oh, well, let's go and get some bread on the way back. Let's go to the market and do this. And we would never walk back on the main road because there's only one way, where place you're going, and that's back to the base. You know, whilst if you're cutting through back alleys, are you going somewhere else? You can't be set up. One of the guys who's my close protection, as soon as we get outside the second last gate, but before we go out through the wire, he's wandered off and left me. He's already gone. And I'm, you know, talking to some of the soldiers, and he yells back nonchalantly to another one and says, oh, you've got Dave.
Mm.
You know, like as in, oh, even though that my soul raison d'etre is to look after him, I'm going to go for a wander, which is exactly what he did. So the guy that is tasked to make sure he wanders off as well. So we go into the main town where there's people around and stuff, and I'm standing there looking around, and I'm completely by myself. They've wandered off. They're into shops. When they've gone into the bakery to get, you know, the Afghan flatbread, they're told that there's none there. So instead of going, okay, and they go, oh, we'll wait. So
we'll all stand still in the middle of town.
So the Taliban must have been going, how good's this? These guys are helping. You know what I mean? Like, and then, and I don't pick this up because I don't have a radio, but I get it off the helmet cam video. One of the guys says to two young soldiers, said, oh, look at that guy. He's got orange staining on his hands. The two guys go, oh, okay. And he said, do you know what that is? And they go, no. And he says, oh, it shows that he's just been mixing HME. And they go, what's HME? And he goes, oh, it's homemade explosives.
Hey, 37, you got a guy coming your way with these orange hands. Stained hands are usually a sign of HME production.
Now, they've seen a guy that they identify who's just been mixing homemade explosives because he's got orange on his hand, and no one does anything. And then eventually, after all this wait, we start walking, but the whole patrol spreads out over, I think, 70 metres, right, instead of being, it's supposed to be a bubble around me so that no one can get near me. Mm. That's why they're there, to protect me. So the guy, which I think they call it point, the guy at the very front, is ahead, and he says, oh, all the workers on the project are all leaving.
They've got a lot of tools here, nobody working.
Now, anyone knows anything is, as soon as the locals are leaving an area, it's because there's an attack about to happen. And they've left all their tools. Now, their tools are the most valuable thing that on earth. You don't leave your tools behind unless you're in a hurry. This Brad comes up to me and says, look at that. This is really suspicious. There's a guy sitting on the side of the road with two kids drinking tea, right? And he goes, that's really suspicious. Can you take a photo, right? And I said, oh, before we take photos, we always just ask permission. You know, excuse me.
Yeah.
We just ask permission of the spotter if he doesn't mind. Anyway, the guy said, yes. So I pull my camera up, but when I went to take it, he pulls his shirt and covers his face.
Ah.
But in the photo, you can see he's got a radio next to him.
No, why?
But then I had to take one last video, and a motorbike had come and stopped the patrol. But interestingly, the patrol didn't care about anyone walking through or driving through, but the motorbike came and stopped themselves because he was making them, the patrol stop. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Because they then had to check in. So completely out in the open, I'm there filming the ditch, and Brad says to me, because we're waiting, he says, oh, wow, what type of trees are they? Because it's blooming, you know, and they're apricot trees. And I said, oh, yeah, I said the apricots are really beautiful. So I take a bit of 2 seconds of video, and I had my pouch for my camera on my ballistic vest. So I've just stopped videoing, opened up my pouch, and I've got my arm up, luckily. and I'm putting the camera into the pouch, and Brad's next to me, and he turned, and the face of horror. It's funny, I can still hear the massive crack of the blast.
Oh, shit, son.
God.
You know, I was blown 10 metres. He was blown into the ditch about 8 or 9 metres away. You know, I was blown up apparently and then landed flat on my back. I was unconscious for a few minutes.
Get to cover, motherfucker!
Interestingly, the two guys who were my designated protection didn't get a scratch because they reckon the closest one was about 100 metres away.
Where the f*** did that come from?
In the suicide bomber. Give me another f***ing tourniquet.
Colin.
Give me another tourniquet.
On his way. Right here.
And one of them was the one with the helmet came in. He, not for months later, that I found out that he watched the bomber dressed all in white walking for 37 and a half seconds towards me through... He weaves through my security thing. No one says anything to him. And then as he hits the road, you can see on the helmet cam him hitting the road and I'm in blue on the other side of the road and then he just runs straight at me. But the thing that saved my life was that he tripped just before. And they haven't told me how it was detonated, whether he detonated or it was remote detonated. But a lot of the blast hit the ground and then came up into us. And look, I think the only thing that saved my sanity is that I didn't see it happen.
Yeah, and of course.
Living every day knowing that a little boy was murdered to try and murder me is a really, really difficult thing to live with. The medic was also critically wounded, and you see him come over to assist me, and his femoral artery was cut. He was bleeding to death, and I was unaware, but a patrol of Navy SEALs had stopped into our base and to lay up for a day. They were in their shorts and T-shirts in the gym, and they just grabbed their guns and ran straight out. They didn't.
Thank God.
And a group of Australians, they were just lining up for lunch, and they just came straight out. Now, if that hadn't happened, there's no doubt that certainly I and the medic would have bled to death. You know, I was in surgery in 52 minutes, you know, which...
That's amazing. In Tarancourt, though?
In Tarancourt. So during this, I still don't know what's happened to me because I thought I'd stood on a landmine. And I was laying in the bed with all my limbs literally in casts or splintered or whatever, and a doctor... American doctor came in, and without any warning, he started telling me about what I had to be careful of, and he was saying how when suicide bombs, they often put feces and things like that, so that if it doesn't kill you, you'll get an infection. The kids that they use have often been sexually assaulted, so quite often they've got HIV. And going through this and saying, so you won't be able to hug, kiss or do anything to any of your family until you're cleared. You know, at this stage, I didn't even know I'd been blown up by a suicide bomber, you know, a child. Then he left. Like, it was like, come, blah, 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 and then he's gone. It's a difficult thing to carry knowing that a 12-year-old illiterate farm boy or whatever just can't have that, you know, hate or the planning or whatever. You know, they literally, he was murdered to murder me is a really, you know, it's a heavy thing to carry. So Brad, my body protected him a lot, but he sadly had one of his buttocks blown off. He had quite a bad brain injuries like I did from the concussion from the blast. From the blast, it's like having, you know, that shaken baby syndrome.
Yeah.
So you know, you get the blast, moves your head one way, but then when you come down and bang, it moves another way. And
yeah, it just smashes your brain inside your skull, doesn't it? Rattles it. Well, while we're on the injuries, though, how are you now? Like, let's get to the positives. I mean, your recovery, I know, is ongoing, but from where you were, which was you were paraplegic at its worst, right?
Yeah. So I, in the first sort of 24 hours, I died twice. I was resuscitated twice. So that is pretty remarkable. I'm still here. I had learned to walk. I've got a ball bearing in my spine, plus all the nerves to my legs had been cut, and I had massive nerve surgery to reconnect and piggyback and graft nerves. So I'd learned to walk maybe 12 months after.
But then you had a setback, didn't you? Did the ball bearing move something?
So my neurosurgeon, I think, neurologist or neurosurgeon had said, if you feel any tingling in your right leg or numbness, just give us a call and we'll get you up here and check you out, you know. Well, it was before Easter, either 2014 or 15. So I'd either been walking for a year or 2 years. I can't remember. And I'd started to feel some tingling in my right leg. So I went, oh, no, it's nothing. And it sort of kept going. And then on the Tuesday, so the Tuesday before Good Friday, I was in the kitchen and my wife said, I think you're dragging your right leg. And I said, oh, yeah, it just feels a bit tingly, a bit numb. Anyway, she went, well, why didn't you, you know, usual, why didn't you tell me? So the next morning we went to my doctor just down the road and she rang my surgeon and they said, get up here, straight away. So we flew to Sydney and then she put me straight into St. Vincent's Hospital where I was, and then all of these experts all came around, but they can't do MRIs because I'm full of metal. But they're trying to do these nerve conduction things, sticking big needles into my leg to sending electric charges down. But by this time, I can't feel anything. After Easter, so the day after Easter Monday, my right leg was completely paralysed. I was in hospital for a month, I think, or in Sydney before coming back to hospital in Canberra. But they looked at it and they came to the conclusion that they could not move, which is the same one that they had after I was wounded, that they couldn't take the ball bearing out because of the fear that I'd become both legs paralysed and then become incontinent and do all that kind of stuff. But they had it. There was a tiny flicker and they said that whilst there was a flicker, there's a hope. So I was just spent the next 5 or so years just working physio every week, keeping my legs in good shape in case it returned. And then about 2 years ago, I was told that there was a new brace.
Is this the German robotic?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that they think my injury would be conducive to this working.
Mm.
But I had to, so I spent a whole year working to strengthen the muscles that were needed to operate the Otterbock brace. They were continual testing me just to say, yes, have you done enough? No, keep going. And then finally they said, yes, we think you can do it. So the guy comes and they're very, you know, they're preparing me for it. And I was only the sixth or seventh person in Australia that had trialed this. So it's very new. And the guy says, this is very black and white. When we strap it on, if you are activating it, you'll hear a beep and it works. No beep, it doesn't work, and it's not, never will work for you. So anyway, so we get there and there's all of these physios from far and wide, you know, watching to come. You know, of course, my family are there. And so we strap it on, parallel bars, you know, and says, okay, go. And so I'm moving and I get to the end, no beep.
Oh.
And it you can see everyone's face is just like this. And he goes, oh, come back, turn around. So help me. And I come, no beep. So I sit down and I'm just like, fuck, you know. Anyway, and then he goes, oh, I forgot to put the sound on. And everyone just goes, what? Anyway, so he says, get up and do it. Well, the next thing is,
beep. Oh, beep. Wow.
So, you know, the other day I walked 3 kilometres around Lake Burley Griffin. So, like, I'm trying to extend. It's life-changing. That's all I can say. It's been the most amazing thing ever.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
This has been another Smart Fella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.